culture is tacit, right? So that, what does that mean, Luke? That means like, you know, whatever your culture is, it's inherent within you. It's in your gut. You just know, it's the rules of the game. Okay, so you just know how to operate. And if you think about it as a bell curve, what happens is we learn our culture from our parents, our grandparents, our teachers, our family. And the reason why they teach us the culture is they want us to fit in, right? So we don't want you to be the only kid who doesn't get invited to the birthday party. So, you know, here are the ground rules as such. Now, it doesn't mean you have to like everything about the culture, but you learn the rules of the game.
Well, Tom, thanks for joining the podcast. I really, really appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Luke. Great pleasure to be here.
So what really stood out for me when I saw your profile there was the word cultural intelligence, right? Now, for me, I hadn't heard that word before, even though it's probably quite big in your space and you're hearing it every single day. For me, I'd never heard it before. And so I guess I wanted to ask for those listening and for myself as well, what is cultural intelligence?
Well, cultural intelligence is defined as the ability to interact effectively with people from diverse cultural backgrounds.
That's succinct. Nail on the head. I love it. And going back to, because I would love to speak about you and what that means for you and the history of your life, but where did this all start? Like, what was the interest initially in this topic? Like, where did the beginning, the genesis of this begin?
The genesis of the topic. Well, I mean, if I look back at, I was looking at doing a topic for my master's thesis in the mid 90s, and a friend of mine who was here from the US suggested to me I should look at the topic of cultural diversity. So I started reading up on that, and then I came across the field of cross-cultural effectiveness. And it just resonated for me because I grew up in Malaysia. I am of Indian heritage, Indian ethnicity, brought up in Malaysia. And one of the things we learn in Malaysia is to navigate cultural differences very early. Because in Malaysia is multi-ethnic, 60% are Malays, about 30% are Chinese, 10% are Indian. So you learn very, very quickly to navigate cultural differences. So therefore, when I read about it, I thought, wow, this makes perfect sense for me. That's what attracted me to it. And as you know, things happen sometimes when you're aligned. Someone put me in front of a client at that stage who were just starting to fly into Asia, and they were having problems with some of their Asian customers, dealing with Asian customers. So they said, can you do some cross-cultural training for us? And of course, being the consultant, I said, yes, although not quite sure what I was going to do. And it's built from there. So we used to call it cross-culture. The heading of cultural intelligence was created by two academics in the early 2000s because it just gives us a broader definition of culture and cross-culture.
It's interesting because, you know, when you're isolated in Australia, for example, right, and you're working with Australian people and you're doing, you know, say you're in like a physical location of a job that's based in Australia, I think more and more people are obviously working people overseas. You assume that people are going to communicate how you communicate, which is a correct assumption because typically they do. And the shock came for me when I started my own business and started outsourcing, right? I started to work with people from multiple countries across the world, across Asia, you know, other countries as well, outside of Asia. And the first thing you notice is, not the first thing, but the thing you notice after some time is that people interpret things differently. And there's a really interesting study. I'm going to paraphrase this study, but it's out of a book called The Social Animal by Elliot Aronson, who's one of the leaders in the field of social psychology. And he says in this study, they got this picture basically, right? And they got people who reside in a country like China, right? Not Chinese descent, but just people that have lived in China. And they get people who are from Western culture, like America. They showed them this photo and they asked them to describe what it meant in relation to the people and the objects in those photos. And generally speaking, the people from America, even the people who were of Chinese descent in America, described the images with language that invoked individuality. And it's centered around an individual than outwards. people from the Chinese culture were about, oh, it's about the community, it's about the whole together. And I found that very fascinating because that trickles through how we do business. And that trickles through, my assumption being, to, you know, how governments relate to other governments across the world and international affairs and things like that. So it's a super fascinating topic.
It is. Yeah. So very much that social experiment that you were talking about, it's also described in The Geography of Thought, which talks about how people see the world. So, you know, the description of how we see the world. So culture is tacit, right? So what does that mean, Luke? That means, like, you know, whatever your culture is, it's inherent within you. It's in your gut. You just know it's the rules of the game. Okay, so you just know how to operate. And if you think about it as a bell curve, what happens is we learn our culture from our parents, our grandparents, our teachers, our family. And the reason why they teach us the culture is they want us to fit in. Right? So we don't want you to be the only kid who doesn't get invited to the birthday party. So, you know, here are the ground rules as such. Now, it doesn't mean you have to like everything about the culture, but you learn the rules of the game. And so therefore, it just becomes very tacit and you operate. So it's like a fish in water. The fish doesn't know it's in the water until you take it out. Same with culture. Until you get out of your culture, you don't actually know. You go, oh, this is normal. This is the way everybody operates, right? And then when you travel or you interact, like you said, with people of different parts of the world, you go, oh, wow, they interpret that differently. They explain things differently. You know, conflict is dealt with differently, etc.
Absolutely. And I'm in Southeast Asia at the moment. And a part of the reason I'm here is to learn the culture as well and to integrate myself in it. And one of the things that the sense of humor is different, right? The sense of humor,
yes.
There's so many differences. So I guess a question I have is, like, it can be related to personal, it can be related to business, but if someone's, you know, starting a business and they're outsourcing or they're building a team overseas, what's the principles they should follow to understand how to approach the culture that they're working with? Is there like a founding principle as opposed to like specific techniques?
Yes. I think always a great place to start is an appreciation that there are differences, right? So firstly, it's the awareness, okay, that there are differences. Because most times we go into a lot of things assuming similarity. So if we assume there are going to be differences, that's not going to make me far more aware for a start. Secondly, it's really useful if I can actually understand what my own cultural values are. Because all cultures, look, are ethnocentric, which means we use our culture as the center mark and we use our culture to compare others. Every culture does it, right? So as long as I understand that I'm ethnocentric, how do I learn to be ethno-relative? Which is, okay, how do I now learn to maybe appreciate different styles and different nuances? So you mentioned you're in Southeast Asia right now. Whereabouts are you?
Currently I'm in Phuket, but I was in the Philippines for about a month before that.
Fantastic. So if you think about Phuket being in Thailand, right? The Thai culture, very gentle people. Very gentle, okay? It is highly unusual for you to see an expression of anger among the Thais. Highly unusual. Because it is a very low value. Part of the value is harmony. Okay, it's high values. How do you create harmony in now that doesn't mean people don't get angry. People do, but they don't display it, for instance, like you would in Australia, right? Like, you know, somebody cuts you off, you're annoyed with something, you call it out. But they don't do that in Thailand. So part of you, in terms of your own cultural intelligence, is okay. What signals do I use to understand if there is disagreement with what I'm saying? If there's a different point of view, how do I invite that? Okay, how do I attune myself to it? And many, many years ago, I was working with a client who was an Australian person, and I remember him saying about his EA, who was Thai. He was basically, he said, you know, she came to me and she said how her one of her close relatives had passed away. And then she started laughing. And she said, I couldn't get it, right? I said, what's wrong with this person? They must be fibbing. They must be giving me a story because they want to have, you know, a day off or something. And one of the things I was explaining to him is that people show emotions in different ways. Like in certain cultures, to laugh is actually to be able to show sadness because I can't cry, right? Whereas we would expect someone to cry. So wow. It's, you know, it's again kind of really understanding. So what am I basing it on, right? I'm assessing based on my own cultural lens. Is that appropriate and correct in this cultural context?
Yeah, wow. That applies to relationships as well. It applies to every aspect of life, you know.
Like absolutely.
I think that, and again, yeah, and the like, so there's, I think that what this really taps into is there's a disempowering way to look at this and an empowering way to look at this, right? It's like, oh, this person doesn't get it. They just don't understand. Like, they're not intelligent or this or that or the other. Truth being told, it's like, if you took the time to step back and being like, okay, what am I missing here? What are the key things that I need to know about X culture or Y culture? And how can I use that in my communication to understand? So an example that you spoke about there, it's like, and I want to relay it back to this other study that I read. I think it's David Buss, his name is, where he talks about what is high and low status in certain societies. And there's in Western cultures, yeah, different cultures, right? Cultures. And he says that in Western cultures, a sense of humor is like a really like a positive thing, a sense of humor, generally speaking, of course.
Yes.
But then in Asian cultures, it's not so desirable. In fact, it's probably actually a negative because they don't relate the same way.
Yeah.
So you have two choices, right? It's like, do you want to be, like get angry and frustrated and then, you know, cycle through all these employees saying to yourself, they just don't get it. Like they're not the same. Or is it like, how are they seeing the world and how can I make it so we're in harmony as opposed to friction?
That's correct. That's correct. So how do I broaden my own understanding of it? And humor is a really funny thing, look, because humor is culturally bound. So what is funny in one culture is not funny in another, which is why when people talk about jokes across cultures, really, really difficult to translate because it's all based on how I'm interpreting the words you're using. So this is a true story of someone who was a very important exec, went to Japan. He was from the U.S., went to Japan, and he was using a translator for the presentation. Right? So he did his first presentation, and as it was his style, he started off with a joke. People laughed, right? And then he did his presentation. And then the next day, he was doing the same presentation, but he had a different interpreter. He told the same jokes, no one laughed. So he thought to himself, this interpreter is not funny. Okay, obviously not able to translate my joke. On the third day, he had the translator from day one, the interpreter from day one. He told the same jokes and everybody laughed. And he said, okay, no, I'm back. He was wise enough to ask the question at the end of the presentation. He asked her, I said, how did you tell those jokes? Because yesterday, the interpreter wasn't funny, but when you say it, it's really funny. And she said, well, I say to the audience, the gentleman has just made a joke. Please laugh. Right? True story.
Well. Wow.
So I always caution my clients, don't use jokes. Humor is different, right? Looking for humor. And see, in the West, look at how humor, so much of the humor is self-deprecating, right? You're put myself down, you know, make a joke on myself rather than, you know. But in lots of Asian cultures, if I self-deprecate, especially if I'm a leader or I'm a speaker, they look at you going like, well, you're supposed to be the expert here. Like, why, you know, it goes back to the hierarchy. You know, so those things are the things that's important. Yeah.
Hey guys, before we dive deeper into this episode, I just wanted to ask a quick question. Are you over worrying about having to create content? Are you over that nagging feeling telling you that you should be posting today?
or I should have posted yesterday, or I should be more consistent with my content. Well, there's no need to worry anymore because my business, Personify, we focus on helping leaders to grow an online presence. And we do this through content creation. We have a multi-step process where we do all of the clip selection, the strategizing, the uploading of the content, the copyright of the content, the video editing, the graphic design, a whole lot across all 10 platforms. So if you're a business owner out there, or if you're a leader, or if you're someone who has something to say and you don't have to worry about creating all this content, which by the way, can take upwards of 30 hours each week, then let us know. We're here to help. You can reach out to me on the website, www.getpersonified.com. GetPersonified.co. It's also in the link below. Peace.
And even sarcasm as well. Like for me, like my humor is sarcastic, and over here, like it doesn't. People are like, what are you talking about? It's like, you're serious,
and it's like, yes.
For some people, it does. Like obviously, there's, you know, we're talking about generals here, right?
Yes,
but generally speaking, like I'll. Yeah, it's like I'd be sarcastic and people are like, what are you talking about? So you have to learn the hard way, I think, unless you're willing to open your mind to it. So that's really, really cool. So for someone who's, you know, perhaps maybe new in business, what would be some guiding principles that you might put forward to them? Like, is there a question they should be asking or any ways to see that?
So I think that whole thing about being able to understand your own culture and your own cultural values, understanding that is important. And then the second thing is, of course, building your cultural awareness of the people you're dealing with. So if you're, say, traveling into Thailand, you're just going in there for a visit, sure, you know, you can just get a what we call a skim of the place or not. But if you're spending, say, time in the Philippines and you have a team in the Philippines, right, you're going to be interacting more, then it's useful to start actually reading a little bit more about the Philippines, the culture, their history, their background, so that you kind of get a sense of, okay, what are the things that's important for them? You know, what are some of the things that I need to be conscious of when I am interacting with them? So, e.g., let's talk about conflict. You know, how the Filipinos deal with conflict is very different to how the Australians deal with conflict. To be expecting a Filipino to speak up and say, oh, look, I disagree. Or look, I have a different point. You know, it's not going to happen. Yet, they will disagree and they will bring another point of view if you give them the space, and you need to be able to watch for how they use language. So I coached a French executive last year. And one of the things that he used to do, and he was responsible for Asia Pacific. And part of his speech patterns, he would always say, do you understand? Do you understand? That's how he used to finish his sentences, right? Do you understand? Do you understand? And at one stage when I was speaking to him, I said to him, has anyone ever responded when you've asked, do you understand? Has anyone ever responded by saying, no, I don't understand? I said, no, no one's ever done that. I said, and yet you ask the question. Right? Like you have that as part of your speech pattern. And what we then worked out was in the French language, to say, do you understand? It's actually quite polite. It's quite normal. In English, do you understand comes across as being quite rude, quite arrogant. So like, how do you find different ways then of saying that? How do you find different ways of checking in that you're understanding? So that's what, you know, those will be the things. So when we talk about cultural intelligence, look, there are four quadrants. One is what we call CQ drive, your motivation and your ambition, your interest in wanting to deal with people of different cultures. Then you have knowledge, which is how much do I need to know about the particular culture? And then that informs your strategy. What's my plan? What do I put into play? And then that informs action, which is how do I execute? So drive, knowledge, strategy, action. Those are the four aspects that's useful in building your cultural intelligence.
Love it. And do you have an example of that in a particular culture? It can be anyone that you've worked with in the past, but an example of someone doing that? Maybe the Philippines would be a good example since I have people there.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. Yeah. I coached someone who was the director of IT. She was based in Melbourne, and her majority of her team were in Manila. And, you know, and she's one of those type A personalities, you know, fast, quick, boom, 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 you know, very serious. And lunch would always be at the desk, you know, the quick 20-minute sandwich type thing. She went to the Philippines, and as you would know, being in the Philippines, lunch is a very important aspect of their day. Lunch is usually an hour, maybe an hour and a half. So she was taken out for lunch, you know, and over lunch, they're asking her questions like, how old are you? Are you married? How much money do you make? And of course, she considers all these questions to be very intrusive. Huh? Mind your own business. And then, of course, lunch is dragging on. And she's saying to herself, her internal dialogue is, she's going, ah, no wonder our productivity is low. You know, these people are inefficient. They're wasting time. So anyway, but she was, you know, but to her credit, she was, you know, a smart woman. So, you know, she started thinking a little bit more about cultural differences. And so she reached out and we started having some coaching conversations. And then what she realized was, actually, it's just a different way of looking at the world, right? Because in the Philippines, relationships are really important. So it's all about relationship building versus task orientation, about getting the job done. So she shifted her mindset so that on her following trips, when she went into Manila at lunch, she just told herself, okay, lunch is going to be an hour, hour and a half. I'm just going to chill. I'll make up the emails later, right? Like, so allowing yourself to be in the moment, that was one. Two is she started taking a personal interest in her team, started asking questions like, so how's your child doing at school? How's the church choir going? How's your husband's business going, right? So actually showing care, showing that she too was interested in relationship building. When she had the Christmas party at the end of the year, where she was, you know, they do it for the team, she had 30 resumes given to her of people who wanted to join her team.
Wow.
Right? And her attrition rate, which was at the start, was running at something like 40%, dropped to under 15, right? Because she started shifting the way she led, started shifting the way she managed. You know, that for me, that she was and is a culturally intelligent leader.
Wow, that's beautiful, and it's so true. Because when I was there, even just in most Southeast Asian countries. Family is everything. Like, it's family, friends, cousins, always around. Always around.
Yes.
Whereas in Australia and in America, and I mean, I'm going to speak for myself, in Australia, it's like, sure, like you see your family, you hang out, you know, whatever, but it's not like every single day. It's probably like maybe, I don't know, once every couple of weeks. Maybe if you're like really family oriented, like once a week, you might have a family dinner or something and that's it. Maybe like text a couple of times a week. That's it. So I come here and I'm like, and I'm chatting to people. It's like, oh, I'm with my cousin right now. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. But I want to come see you and visit you and meet you with my cousin. And I'm like, what? Why? I don't understand. But it's very family oriented and very, very, like you said, relationship oriented. That's a huge part of it. And I've heard the same thing happen over and over again with people from the West, dealing with countries like the Philippines, where they think that, just think differently. And it's like this frustration. It's like a... But again, there's a way to go around it. So I really appreciate that.
So one of the things that's really important for leaders to understand is that for so many people in those cultures, they actually work for the leader. The relationship is with the individual, right? Not the company.
Yeah, wow.
So very much in the West, I work for the organization, right? I work for, let's say, IBM. And then John Smith is my manager. Compared to, actually, I work for John Smith, who's my manager, and we work for IBM. Mm. Right? So, shift.
So would you say that it's about that the more important thing is to focus on, rather than like, you know, doing team meetings, just having an individual connection with each of the staff members? Is that what the approach might be?
Yeah. No, you would have team meetings because that's important for the collective. but you also want to actually have enough time for individual meetings. Now, you want to really make sure we're getting a connection with those individuals so that they feel it's about care. Look, you know, they want to know that you care for them. Right? That comes, that's very much part and parcel of the play, which is why you find that even in the workplace, people spend time on the weekends with their work colleagues, right? You know, in places like Australia, you go like, oh, man, I work with you all week. Leave me alone.
Go away.
Yeah. So it's just a different shift. It's just understanding what are the values that's important. So why are the values? So for instance, hierarchy. You know, in Australia, we value very much egalitarianism. We are one of the very few countries in the world where we call the prime minister by their first name, a nickname, Albo. You know, like we have those things. I mean, you won't get that in Asian countries because it's very hierarchical. So, you know, it's always about your titles, your qualifications, your family, your sir, uncle. You know, all, it's a way of showing respect. Whereas, you know, we don't do that. I remember having a client who was British and, you know, he used to say, you know, please stop. I wish they would just stop calling me uncle. Right? They make me feel so old and I'm not their uncle anyway.
Or sir.
Respect. It's a way of respect. Just take it on. It's easier for you to take it on than have to change all of them.
Huge. Incredible.
Deal with your own stuff.
I agree. I wanted to shift the conversation to one of your other areas of expertise / passion, which is conscious aging. Now, I hadn't heard of that terminology or those words put together before. So I'd love to give you the floor and just explain what conscious aging is.
Sure thing. So if you think about you think of aging. So aging is the process of getting older. Right? So the day we're born, we are aging. And one day we will exit out, right? So the two definite seminal points of life, the day you are born and the day you die, definite, guarantee. Okay. Consciousness is being aware of our surroundings. So conscious aging is really about how can I be more aware of the transitions that I'm going through in my life. Now, when we're younger, we have specific transitions. We move from a baby to a young child, to a teenager, to a young adult, so those are 20, 18, 20, you know, those are all seminal kind of markers. But as you then get older, it all gets merged. Like there's no markers in your 40s and 50s. So how do you transition? And things you may be experiencing, e.g. menopause for women, empty nesting, kids leaving home, redundancy, health issues, being the sandwich generation, parents, you know, dying parents, kids, all those are transition periods, transition moments. And sometimes we are not equipped for them. We don't talk about them enough. We don't, you know, we don't prepare ourselves. It just automatically says, so, you know, it'll be fine. So that's what conscious aging is.
And why is it important for someone, say a millennial, to know about conscious aging? Does that apply to them or is it only when you reach a certain age?
Absolutely. For a millennial, it's important because they, as a generation, are going to live far longer on the planet, right? So over the last 100 years, we have extended our lifespan by more than 30 years. So kids born today can basically think about living till they're about 100. Okay? Now, if you think of your retirement age, retirement, most times being, you know, say in Australia, 67, some of the Asian countries, 65. So you retire at that age, you've got another 30 years. So what are you going to do in that time? A. B, how are you going to fund it? How are you going to afford to do that? So hence, the reason why we want to be conscious is actually thinking about, okay, my life is actually in stages. how do I do things differently? What are some things I need to do? So, you know, therefore you see that today, right? People may study for a while, they travel, they come back, they work, they travel. So that's all those shifts. A friend of mine just wrote an article in the Guardian paper that came out last week. And she was talking about the increasingly, the divorce rates among the over 50s. How it's becoming increasingly more the gray divorce. Because in the old days, you used to say, it doesn't matter, I'll stick it out. Now, people are saying, listen, I'm 50. I'm going to be around for another 30 years. Right? I want a chance at something new. I want a chance at something different. So people, you know, so all those things, going back to school, the number of startups, which are now being started, you know, being founded by people in their 50s, people rethinking careers. So that's what conscious aging is about. Because what happens as we age, Luke, well, you know, someone said this, right? If old age was a destination, you'd get very few tourists coming to it. Okay. Wow. So it's not something that we choose to go to, but it happens to all of us. We all age. So how do we do it? How do we transition into that? I believe that as we get older, how do we transition to becoming as elders? How do we share the information?
Yeah, well, I think also there's been, from what I can gather based on my experience, but also reading on history and things like that, there's a negative connotation to being elder, right? But if you look at ancient cultures and ancient societies, being older was like wisdom. You'd go speak to them for knowledge and wisdom and things like that. And now it feels like it. This is my perception. It just feels like we treat older people like senile and like, I'd put them in a nursing home. Let's just sort them out, you know. But there's and me personally, I love speaking to people who are at that point in their life because there's so much there, so much history, so much emotion, so much knowledge that we can gather from them. And it feels like as a Western culture, I mean, specifically, but also with the rise of the internet as well to a degree, we've lost the feeling of seeing someone who's older as holding wisdom, right? Because they've gone through those rite of passages.
That's correct.
And they're like, oh, yeah, I remember when I was in my 20s, I was doing this. In 10 years' time, you'll feel completely different. Or in 20 years' time, this will happen. And you're like, oh, yeah, whatever. And then it happens in your life and you're like, you're 100% right. So,
yeah. So I think a lot of it is also because we live now in a very ageist society. You know, we live in a very youth-oriented society, and technology has actually forced a lot of that because, you know, the technology is changing so quickly. So therefore, the young are the ones who are really picking that up much quicker. Even if you look at the average age of CEOs in multinationals, it's been declining over the last 10 years or so. You know, at one stage, you had to be in your 60s. To be a CEO, then it became in the 50s. Now it's actually very much in the 40s, you know, because of the demands of the job and having the energy to keep up to it. So hence those things become kind of important. Yeah.
Massively. And there's also, there's someone I'm speaking to on the podcast in about a month's time. He does rite of passage work where he actually, you know, because we've lost the rite of passage for the most part, and I really feel like, just from speaking from my own experience, having a business, for example, is a really cool rite of passage because you learn so much about yourself as a side note, right? But it takes people through a rite of passage, not just for, you know, like going from a boy to a man, so to speak, but also for people transitioning to other parts of their life, like you mentioned there as well, which I'm assuming what conscious aging is. It's like from 40 to 50, how's my life different from 50 to 60? So I wonder, is it in decades or is it in like every couple of years, or is it just a feeling sense of like,
it's actually, I prefer to think about it in as stages of life.
Yes.
So rather than chronological, you know, because, you know, today's 50-year-old, you get a range of people who have different experiences of being 50, right? So it's about stages, you know, what stage of life am I at? And then how do I transition that? Because, and again, that's something that's missing, those rites of passage. There was a time when you used to officially retire from an organization. You know, they used to give you the gold watch, give you a capital, you know. But now you're just made redundant and you're out. they escort you out.
Get out of here.
get out of here. You know, those things are not useful for one's sense of self-esteem. And hence, how do we actually utilize that? And to your point before, look, about the elder, the days of us looking up for wisdom, because today we can get any information we want on the phone, right? I want to look something up. Mm. I don't need to go talk to somebody about it. I don't need to ask somebody about it. I can look it up. And one of the things we want to help people distinguish is you have data, loads of data available, which then gives you information,
yeah,
which then becomes knowledge. But then out of that knowledge, how do we create wisdom? Right? So it's the tiers of it. I'll tell you a story. I just got back from Sydney. And last weekend, I was in the Sydney CBD. I had lunch with a friend of mine walking along. I had a time in the afternoon before an evening catch up with someone else. I walked by this bar and I saw the signage on the front. I was reading the description of cocktails. This young man comes up to me and says, why don't you come in and have a look, right? I said, okay. At time, these things only happen when you're traveling, Luke, as you would know. You know, these serendipity things that happen. So I walk in, they show me the bar. So this is day 3 of operations. Day 3, they've just opened. They show me upstairs, small little bar. Then they walk me downstairs. They show me, you know, nice, intimate, comfortable. I said, wow, it's nice. So day 3, and they said, okay, well, since you're here, would you like a cocktail? I said, yeah, why not? Right. So then I said, I look up whiskeys. I said, no, I shall have a whiskey. Okay. So we end up having one of the a nice top shelf Japanese whiskey. I'm enjoying that. And I'm looking at it and I say, actually, you know, you need to increase your range of whiskeys here because you're not covering the gamut of whiskeys. Right. So then I started giving, I say, you know, you need to have one from here. You need to have another one from here. You need to have a sweet whiskey. And they're writing all these notes down. Okay. And I said to them, I am so pleased that my 30 years of whiskey drinking, because I'm a big fan of whiskey. I'm a whiskey aficionado, you know. I'm able now to share this with you because these were 3 young men, late 30s, early 40s. This is their first enterprise, hospitality business. You know, we got along really well. I'm sharing all this information with them about whiskey. I said, like, get this. You know, and they were so grateful.
Wow.
I told them, I feel like an elder. You know, I feel as an elder being able to pass on this information to you. I said, take it. Do with it what you want, right? So they gave me the title, the whiskey consultant. Right? You're the whiskey consultant, Tom. I know, that could be a new career for me.
Well, there's a beauty in being, for lack of better words, being stupid, like being able to not know things and to like have someone come in and school you and teach you on stuff. It's like, it's almost like your capacity to be stupid is linked to being successful in a weird way, right? Because you have to be the person in the room who's like, okay, I don't know this. You're 20, 30 years older than me. You've been through this before. Maybe there's some contextual things that need the bridge that I can, you know, create the bridge for, so to speak. But there is wisdom there and nuggets there that are lifelong that one can't even acquire,
yes,
until they've been here for a certain amount of time. And I think that my generation, we equate knowledge with wisdom when wisdom is something that is comes about through an equation. And one of those equations, one of those parts of this equation is age. So
yeah. So that's right. So age and wisdom tend to go together, but sometimes age turns up by itself. Right. So you get people who are older who are not wise, but most times you want it together. Which, going back to the wisdom piece, which is really why we encourage organizations to look at multi-generational teams. Right. Just like we look at cross-cultural, diverse, culturally diverse teams outperform homogenous teams. Loads of research on it. Loads.
Wow. That's
like
incredible.
Loads. But a well-led diverse team will outperform a homogenous team. A well-led and well-managed intergenerational team with generational diversity, because now you have 5 generations in the workplace. A generational, multi-generational team will outperform, a single generational team.
Why is that?
Easily. Because you'll have different ways of looking at the world, different ways of, you know, somebody who's much older being able to share their experiences, somebody who's younger saying, hey, what about this? What about doing it that way?
Yeah, wow.
So yeah, hence, wow. To your question of learning, I think a great value to generate for all of us is the value of curiosity. How do we be curious? How do I ask? How do I appreciate that I don't know everything there is to know? You know, Carol Dweck wrote the book around fixed mindset versus growth mindsets. So growth mindset is about, I'm always wanting to learn. I'm always asking questions, compared to a fixed mindset of, I know everything there is to know. Right? Because that's very, very fixed. Alvin Toffler wrote in his book 50 years ago in Future Shock, one of the key skills of the 21st century is the ability to learn, unlearn, and relearn. Right? Learn, unlearn, and relearn. Because you need to unlearn stuff. You can't just pile things on, right? Like some things you just got to drop, man. Like, so hence, if you're traveling to Asia, you may have had certain biases and certain stereotypes. And then you need to kind of be there and go, oh man, like maybe that wasn't true. Like, I got to drop that.
You need to be dynamic. You need to be flexible.
Correct. Yes.
That's beautiful. So Tom, what is, if someone wants to work with you, it could be the conscious aging stuff. It could be the cultural intelligence stuff. Where should they go and how can they find out more about you?
Well, they can certainly look me up on my website, www.culturalsynergies.com, or they can find me on LinkedIn, Tom Verghese, V-E-R-G-H-E-S-E. Yeah, so, you know, I think like it's one of, for me, I've been an independent consultant loop now for 30 years, right? This is my 30th year as an independent consultant. I have been really fortunate. I've met some great clients. I've learned some great things. I've traveled. I've run assignments now in 40 different countries. So I've been very fortunate. And part of it is at the core is I'm an educator. Right? So that's the core of who I am. My parents were educators. My grandfather was an educator. I'm a third generation educator. And, you know, my first 10 years was spent doing something else. I came back to education in my 30s. And that's where I've been ever since. So, you know, if I can in any way help instill, you know, some new ways of thinking, then fantastic. Because the more I teach, the more I learn. Conscious aging, I moved into that area because I was interested in it. You know, personally, I was interested in it. So
beautiful, beautiful. Is there any wisdom that you want to, is there one or two things or perhaps anything you'd like to leave behind?
I think the conversation that we have had today, I mean, a couple of things that really stood out in our conversation here. One is it reminded me of the importance of curiosity, which you have demonstrated. Because, you know, you reached out, you were really curious, asking. So that whole thing about curiosity is something that I think is really important. Two, that ability to reflect. And you talked about it in your own experiences of traveling, you know, being in the Philippines and being in Thailand, you know, it's quite different. There's similarities and there are differences. So that ability to reflect and be observant. And I think the third thing is being a learner, you know, the ability to be agile, flexible, leaning into learning. Just, I think that's what makes life fun, right? Like, I mean, I love learning stuff and going, oh, gosh, you know, I mean, I'm always amazed at how 2 weeks ago I didn't know that stuff, right? So you feel also that's part of your personal growth.
There's nothing more beautiful than learning something and realizing that you're wrong. So that's awesome. I love that. Well, Tom, thanks for joining. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure. And I'll see you on the flip side.
You're most welcome, Luke.